Chair will call the Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. Members, we are not at quorum yet, so we can't take any formal action. However, one of the items before us today is an informational hearing on House File 1254, Chair Considine's bill. This committee is televised and streamed across the state, so I think this is incredible merit, even though we're not at quorum yet, to indeed hear about House File 1254. And as soon as we get to quorum, we'll start taking formal actions. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask Chair Considine to come forward and with his testifiers and proceed with the informational hearing on House File 1254. Chair Considine, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a program that's been going on in Blue Earth County now for 4 years. And while I had nothing to do with it, I am incredibly proud of it because it is my former department and my former county. Referred to often as before the yellow line, it attempts to divert people from the judicial system by having a social worker right in the booking area and trying to get them services they needed. But I'm going to turn it over now to guy that used to be my boss and still likes to give me advice. Not always what I'm wanting to hear, but it's I actually call Mike quite often when I need to get a well-rounded look at an issue. So Chief Deputy Mike Maurer.
Well, and Chair Costa, if he lives in your district, he actually still is your boss.
No, he doesn't.
Welcome, Chief. We're really anxious to hear about this program. I've heard bits and pieces of it from Representative Considine, and I think I'm just really taken by the forward thinking that your community has relative to this issue of mental health and corrections. And so please, so welcome to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and representatives. I am Mike Maurer. I'm the Chief Deputy at the Blue Earth County Sheriff's Office. To try to understand how the Yellow Line project works is that we had a lot of mental health and chemical health issues in our community that were getting poured into our jail. Just the numbers were staggering. We had staff that were not trained to deal with them. This goes back to the time even when Jack was in programming, the numbers just started to slowly increase and increase and increase and increase. Obviously, with the mental health facilities trimming back, we were starting to get more. We're also seeing a pretty significant use in our detox. The price or the cost of detox was just skyrocketing. We're in a community of college students, so the alternative to deal with a college student that's unruly is to take them to detox, and therefore the cost was going through the roof. Our hospital costs were seeing extreme spikes in that. And the reason is because as officers or our officers really only had three choices. We had detox, the hospital, and jail. And not only with those three choices, they all had to fall in a spectrum. So if they were too aggressive, the hospital wouldn't take him. Or if they were too aggressive, detox wouldn't take him. And everything fell back to jail. That was the last resort. If the hospital couldn't take him and if the detox couldn't take him, they all fell back to jail. Well, they have to receive a charge to come back to jail. And I was just worn out. I met with our human services individuals. It happened in my office in September of 2015, and I said, we need more alternatives. We need to find a place to go with some of these people, especially towards the end when all of a sudden people were checking themselves into the hospital with mental health issues and leaving as criminals because they would strike a nurse or they'd see a physician and the physician would say, you don't meet the criteria, and let them go, and they'd step out of the hospital and commit a crime. And where were they ending up? In jail. They recognized they had a problem. They took their own initiative to seek help and were ending up criminals. And that had to stop. So I met with Angie and Phil, our director, and I said, through the use of human services, law enforcement and human services don't always agree on everything. But we've got a great relationship in our county. And I said, through these resources, can we find some alternatives? Can we think of something different? Can we go outside the box? So we set up some defined goals, and they were improved access to services for individuals with mental health or mental illness and chemical dependency, to improve their engagement in services through timely response, and then to reduce our bed jays for people that necessarily or didn't necessarily need to be there. And Angie and Phil took it back to the table, and we discussed almost 12 months before we could even outline a project because it was so new. And it was interesting to see human services try to understand how everything had to fall in a bottle. Well, if you didn't meet this criteria, you don't go here, and you don't go here, and they end up in jail. And I will let Angie now move forward to kind of tell you what she, along with us, worked into to help us at least have another alternative.
Thank you, Chief Deputy Maurer. Welcome, Ms. Youngerberg, to our committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and representatives. Thank you for allowing us to be here today. We are very excited to talk about the Yellow Line project. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I'm the Director of Business Operations for Blue Earth County Human Services. As my colleague, Chief Deputy Maurer, indicated, we came together in 2015, but really put a project together 24/7 with 24/7 response time in 2017. And why did it take so long? It took so long because there's no real national model for us to follow. So we took a risk, and we were dreaming and said, what can we, from a human services standpoint, do at any point from the call to service, from when law enforcement has a call to service, to the point that they're booked into jail so that we can prevent unnecessary incarcerations? And so Chief Deputy Maurer did a really nice job explaining how the reality was for him and his staff. What it was like for myself and my staff is that if we would be working with someone or if there was someone in need and they were in jail and they would call human services, we would say when they are done and served their time in jail, they can come and receive voluntary services through human services when they're done. And I can't believe that I'm sitting here telling you this story today because my philosophy has shifted completely. That is the point in time in which human services should be responding to individuals. That is that crisis point in which we should be involved in providing services. So we together believed that there has to be more that can be done other than detox, hospital, and jail. We can have a whole continuum of services available. So what we did is we literally put a yellow line on the floor in the jail. So where pre-booking opens up into intake, there's a yellow line, and it says the Yellow Line Project. And we have a staff. We have a social worker, great individual, sitting in that pre-booking area. And what they're doing is we're starting with a screening. And that screening is very brief because we know that that process can move very quickly. So what we're screening for is mental illness or chemical dependency, typically by self-report or observation. We do this in approximately 10 minutes. We do this in pre-booking, or it can be done out on the street. So we've been called to community locations to do this as well. We're offering this to everyone, whether or not it's a mandatory hold or they're an individual that's being booked and released right away. We are offering this voluntary screening to everyone. We have a response rate of 94% in terms of engaging. 94% of people are being offered that screening, which is really good considering we're trying to cover 24 hours a day and a lot of people. And then we use releases of information so that we can provide the information that the person gives us with law enforcement, with the jail, with others at their discretion. The program is simple. It requires three yeses. So the officer has to refer the person for services. The person has to be voluntary in receiving those services, and we have to have screened them to be either found to be struggling with mental health or chemical dependency, and we believe that services could help. You have a pathways document in your packet today. I'm not going to go through that in detail, but it's a visual about different stages of our program. We started in pre-booking, and it gives kind of a step-by-step process of where we screen the individual. Sometimes people tell us no, that they don't want to be screened, or they don't, maybe not the most trusting at that point in time. But if the person is then jailed, we will circle back and do another screening at their request at a later time. And so you'll see some of those pieces documented in that workflow. So we started in pre-booking. We moved to the street. We're now engaging in a project expansion in working with individuals who are in jail where we can try and cut their jail stay down to 1 to 3 days and try and get them back out into the community sooner than typical. Chief Deputy Maurer talked about our three measurable goals, and I would like to share just briefly some of the outcomes that we've had. In Blue Earth County, they see 2,450 bookings a year. That was 2018 data. Of those that we screened, the self-report of mental health or chemical health problems was 81%. Other reports that I've seen in the state of Minnesota range from 30%, 50%, sometimes into 60%. But with a plain-clothed social worker asking the questions versus a uniformed officer or jail staff, we're getting more and more what I would say is honesty in terms of the need for services. Of those that have been referred to our program and worked with, the cornerstone of our project is once they're referred, they work with a community-based coordinator who works with that individual for up to 60 days into the community, addressing very measurable short-term goals to try and change their pathway on a very quick basis. For all of those individuals, our success rate has been over 80% have successfully completed all of their goals with that engagement. It takes quite a bit of active outreach on the part of our staff, but we're finding that is the trick. That is the thing that will help people feel more safe and more comfortable. Our long-term outcomes, we've been around for a couple of years, and so we're starting to get some more long-term outcomes. Well, this isn't a recidivism rate that I'm going to share with you, because we don't have access to all things in terms of all law enforcement interaction. What we have access to is Blue Earth County-specific data and the various jurisdictions within our project. We look at 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months. Are we seeing those individuals back in jail? And kind of the middle of the road is that six-month point. 6.25% of people we have seen back. So that is a staggering number, really, when you consider over 90% we don't see again. And so anecdotally, we can look back at some of those individuals and say homeless veteran that was in jail every 3 months, what felt like clockwork, is now housed, gainfully employed, and connected with services. He's not been back in jail. The mom who was resorting to theft to feed and diaper her child is now no longer engaging in those activities and is working actively to support her family. And so we've seen some incredible outcomes, including our detox costs are down $100,000 annually and our state hospital costs are down $200,000 annually because we are so far upstream in this process. Representative Considine has authored a bill that will be heard in Health and Human Services, which helps pay for the community-based care coordination service to make it an MA reimbursable activity, and we've been working on that since 2016. It passed last year and was part of the omnibus bill that in Human Services was ultimately vetoed, so we're back again this year as we work with the Department of Human Services and CMS to clean up some language to make sure that this is available to all counties and jurisdictions and tribes in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for hearing from us today.
Thank you, Ms. Youngerberg. I'm I'll be a little bit of a cheerleader for our state, but I was caught by the observation that there was no national model to follow here. and that certainly didn't deter you all. You understood there was a risk here. And so that seems to be something intrinsically, I would argue, Minnesotan, taking good risks, being innovative, and being smart and compassionate at the same time. Chair Kassar, do you have any other testifiers to share?
No, I don't.
Very well. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Considine, and to the testifiers, thank you. My community was law enforcement back in the 80s, and mid to late 80s, my law enforcement community was trying to do something like this. What can we do? Law enforcement across the state has been working on this issue for over 30 years. And we've had pushback from, not from the law enforcement side, from the other side, saying we can't do this, we can't do this. I thank you for finding a way to come up with something. Law enforcement has known this for decades and trying to deal with it. And unfortunately, some of the things that we've been forced to do by personnel policy have made it harder for us to do that because our policies say we shall do this, or the officer gets into trouble. The officer no longer has any discretion of how to handle things other than to bring them to jail. And I would like the chiefs and the sheriffs to look at their policies to give the officers discretion how to handle things in the best way for each individual case. So thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's a good step to go to help these people that actually need the help instead of sending them through the criminal justice system.
I concur, Representative Johnson. And obviously, and so I do have a question relative to that, to both of you, but obviously it seems to me for a law enforcement officer to be able to have that ability to make some wise discretion, that there has to be some infrastructure to tap into to be able to do that. It seems that that's that's what you were running into, Sheriff, as when you were I think you said something like I was just getting tired, and I think the tiredness had to do with I could see, to Representative Johnson's point, I could see what ought to happen here. And we just don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the design, the system here to do that. So my question is, was this a big, like, cultural shift, or rather a big cultural lift for your law enforcement, rank and file folks, or was it easily embraced, or what did you? What did you have to do to work with your rank and file in order to get the kind of buy-in that seems to be happening?
I would like to call it a cultural change.
Okay.
Being in the law enforcement for 30-plus years, coming up through the ranks, initially our job was to go out and deal with people, and if they committed a crime, you arrest them. 30 years into this. I did have an opportunity in my career to, I got promoted and I oversaw the jail, and that's where I started to see the change, and we could build a change into our organization. It's a top-down philosophy. We were able to get things through human services that were accessible immediately to officers that weren't available before. So that was what made the cultural shift or cultural change so much easier, is that officers have a tendency to work on immediacy. We have to get things done. We have to move. We have to go because something's going to happen next. And there was just always too much time. And that's what Angie and Phil and I stressed on, is this, you got to get resources to us that are available immediately so that we can and are reliable. And that working with our mobile crisis team and some of these different options, they allowed us to have opportunity or access to things in a timely fashion that officers were willing to change their philosophy because they had more options and they were immediate. They were there. They were just doing business as usual because that's all we knew was business as usual. So we had to train. We had to train differently. We had to make them understand how this was going to work. We got great buy-in right away. We didn't. I I can't think of any feedback in Angie. We expected more feedback and more. I expected more pushback, saying that this isn't going to work, and I really got very limited. So they were as much as I wanted something more. They were looking for it too.
Very well, Ms. Jungerberg, I imagine that folks in your field were perhaps similarly challenged in terms of, you know, working with law enforcement, rank and file, in a different way as well.
That's absolutely true, Mr. Chair. You know, I would say that Mike touched on it earlier, that we started with developing the relationship between our department. This hasn't been an easy project. I'll be the first to say that. We've hit bumps because we didn't have a national model. We didn't have something that we could just put into place nicely. And, you know, every form, every policy, every decision tree, every model we created, you know, by starting with our relationship and what our core beliefs were. You know, and then as we move into operations is where we bring in the rest of our staff. And Mike is right. I mean, human services is siloed in many respects. And if a person doesn't fit neatly into categories, it's really hard to know exactly how and what we can help them with. And so this was a little bit of permission giving to staff to say, be creative. This is our artwork. This is what we do. This is what we do best. And how do we help an individual at that point? Mike talked about training. And, you know, in the difference in law enforcement and social services is, you know, Mike can say that this is really what you need to do and how you need to do it. In human services, man, we have to slow down and say, and this is why we do it. And let's talk about all of these other pieces behind it. And so it was a little bit more challenging in some respects to get some of the buy-in on our side. But, you know, I think we've come a long ways. Do we have longer to go? Yes. I mean, of course, we always do. But even some of the officers that I thought would be most resistive that are, you know, the ones that are frequently jailing individuals, they're some of our biggest users right now. I mean, they're the ones saying, you know, I am sick of putting this person in the jail 6 times because nothing changed with any of those 6 times. Let's try something new. And so that's really wonderful to see.
Terrific. I look forward to coming to visit you all in the interim and hopefully have an opportunity to interact with the rank and file in both your sectors. And you said something earlier about tapping into, Ms. Jungerberg, you know, the community. You know, the array of community services is part of that ongoing relationship once they've gone through the initial yellow line, you know, process. And, you know, we I don't know if you know this, but we had your public safety chief here at the beginning of the session, Mr. Miller, I believe, right?
Ed Miller.
He shared with us some big, powerful thoughts that have shaped our theme of community-centered public safety. You all seem to be living that very well. Kudos to you. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few logistic questions. So you're working with social workers, you know, drug counselors, those folks. So are they on call? Is there a crisis team that's always on call, or how does that work?
Sure.
Ms. Jungerberg.
Excuse me. During business hours, human services staffs the pre-booking area of the jail. We have 2 staff during the day. They both have mental health and chemical health background. Actually, one of them also has a probation background. But chemical health has been both of their specialties. And so they do the screenings and the community-based care coordination. After hours is a challenge, especially in rural Minnesota. We wanted to design this project so that it could be replicable in areas that didn't have great population or lots of workforce. And so we partnered with our mobile crisis team and worked with them on adjusting some of what they do to provide the after hours coverage. And we found that our screening tools and documents were almost the same. There are only 3 questions different. We're saying we have a common mission. Why are we duplicating a workforce when we can do this? And so they're providing that after hours and overnight and weekend coverage, and it's really brought our teams together in a way so that we can do that. But, yes, social work staff, practitioner level, 4-year degreed individuals is who we're talking about.
Representative Christensen.
Just to follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there enough of those folks out there? I'm just wondering about the job market. I mean, are the, and especially in greater Minnesota, I'm wondering if the those qualifications are out there. Thank you.
Ms. Youngerberg.
I think like much of the state, we too experience a shortage of workforce. I mean, we have this ever-growing demand and need, and we do have a shortage in workforce. We have not had troubles staffing at this point, but, you know, a few years from now, it's hard to predict. I know in many areas in social services, you know, especially the direct care side of things, we're struggling with getting enough workforce and availability of workforce in that. But in this particular niche, we've not had a problem with that.
Very well. Well, I thank you both, Ms. Youngerberg and Deputy Chief, or Chief Deputy, Michael Moore, for being here with us today, but more importantly, for the groundbreaking work that you're doing. And I seriously, Representative Considine is going to make sure that I'm down his way in the coming months, and I hope to be able to interact with both of you and your colleagues with your work. Representative Considine, good luck with your bill, Health and Human Service, and I really appreciate having this committee be informed by this vital work because we know we're increasingly hearing the impacts of mental illness and chemical dependency in particular on our public safety systems. And I suspect that as we continue to move forward, we're going to be looking for more and more innovative ways for us to step in and respond powerfully, perhaps the way that you all are doing, but also in other ways as well. So with that, and I do want to say, members, that this is actually a wonderful way for us to start because today's theme is Mental Health and Neurodiversity Day in the committee. And so we've got several bills teed up to address these issues. So thank you again, and good luck to you, Representative Consulate. I'll be tracking your bill carefully. Members, we do have a quorum, and so I'm wondering if, Representative Lucero, you would be so kind as to move the minutes of March 6th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Any discussion on that motion? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lucero. With that, the chair will call up House File 377, Representative Dean. Chair Dean, as you come forward, I think you have an A1 amendment that you'd like us to move to shape the bill up so it can be before us the way you want it to be before us. And your motion will be to lay this over for possible inclusion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move 377 over for possible inclusion and then offer the A1 amendment.
Very well. All in favor of adoption of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Dean, House File 377 as amended is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, 377, is introduced so that we can authorize some funding for a sector of the population that sometimes has challenges when encounters happen with law enforcement or other types of emergency responders. And I think that it's something that's very much needed. It's not casting dispersions at any group of emergency responders. It's more to say that, you know, this is one of those areas that a little more training and a little bit more education will go a long way. It's to improve those crisis situations where individuals that have an autism spectrum disorder or other non-visible health issues. And the whole intent is that, you know, a little bit of training may go a long, long way for this. We don't have the dollar amounts put forward at this time, but should this be included in the omnibus bill, we will make sure that that's part of that at that time. So with that, I actually have several testifiers that are going to be able to tell you a lot more than I can about this issue, so I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and council members. My name is Jillian Nelson. I am the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota, a member of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, the Coalition for Children, the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, and I'm also an adult with autism. I'm here today to speak with you about House File 377, which we are hoping will appropriate approximately $400,000 over 2 years to expand autism training for law enforcement in Minnesota. Autism is a lifelong neurological disorder. Nationally, 1 in 59 individuals are living with autism, and those numbers are even higher in Minnesota, with a rate of 1 in 42. Minnesota has an outstanding reputation as being a leader in quality of life for families and individuals with autism. Sadly, however, autistic people are 7 times more likely to be the victim of a crime because of vulnerability, and 12 times more likely to become involved in the criminal justice system without criminal intent. This bill is modeled around COP Autism Response Education Program, or CARE, which was developed here in St. Paul. This program has been groundbreaking in ending this cycle, and this is the type of training that this bill hopes to extend throughout the state. This model uses an intuitive officer training officer three-pronged approach that ties together education, community engagement, and technology. CARE pairs with knowledgeable autism experts to teach the basics of autism and how to support someone with autism. And then the officers learn how to follow up and build trust and relationships with the individuals with autism and their families. And this approach improves not only the safety for the community and the officers, but it also increases inclusion and fosters community integration. This training has been developed working directly with law enforcement and public safety community, individuals on the spectrum, and parents and support networks of those individuals. I have been privileged to be a part of this training in the classroom, and as a resident, see firsthand how officers engage with the information and work with our community. I've also been a trainer for the existing autism training through the Crisis Intervention Program. This program focuses on providing information about what is autism, but it fails to offer tools beyond crisis intervention. While I can say that any training is better than no training, I can unequivocally support more extensive training and follow-up outreach to improve the lives of individuals with autism by preventing future crisis situations. This bill will also offer access to law enforcement additional mobile technology. I've been a user of one of these tools since its inception. What this app does is it allows users to digitally disclose to law enforcement about their disability using Bluetooth technology. When a user is within 30 to 100 feet of an officer using the app, their beacon, which is a small device, it looks just like this, that they carry with them, it sends an alert to the officer's phone, linking to a profile for the user. The profile contains information that the user chooses to disclose about their disability, de-escalation strategies, behavioral triggers, and emergency contact information. Users can even include a video or a sound file on their profile to help with de-escalation. This application has been instrumental in keeping me safe when interacting with law enforcement on multiple occasions. We are happy to demonstrate. We have Officer Rob Zink here, and he has the app. If anyone is interested in seeing how that works, my profile is currently on his phone because I am within 30 to 100 feet of him. Basically, continuing to expand this education is a common sense step for Minnesota. It's creating an accessible and safe community. The Autism Society of Minnesota strongly supports this program, and we're asking today for your committee support for House File 377 as we work towards expanding this training statewide. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. And I see the phone is moving, is going around. So, Representative Sir, you have a quick question for Ms. Nelson?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. If you're in a crowd and there's a bunch of people around you, as the officer who might be carrying this gets closer, is there a way to single you out?
My beacon includes a photograph of me. So I will be honest, I'm on the user side, so I've never seen the law enforcement application side. But I know that it does include that picture. The ideal isn't that every time the phone bings, an officer will pick up and be like, who has a disability. The idea is that if they see something, strange happening, something concerning happening, and they get that ping, that they'll pick that up and look and say, oh, that's Jillian over there. I see that she's flapping her hands. It looks like she might be a little overwhelmed. She's autistic. Here's what her profile says and how I can help her. And then they can proceed to make an informed decision. If my profile says I visibly flap when I'm excited, you don't need to bother me if you see this, then they know, oh, everything's fine. I can go about my day and hopefully not create that engagement that could cause potential trauma.
Representative
Sarah? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just draw members' attention that it is agnostic to a particular vendor, which is a good thing, because there might be multiple applications out there that would be a better fit for different departments of law enforcement agencies. The second question I would have for the testifier, the piece that you carry, is that, okay, if you could pass that around, that'd be great.
It's basically like a scan card.
And then my question would be, does this require needing to be charged, or
absolutely not. I've left it in my wallet since the day I've got it, and we're still running. I think last I checked, I was still on 91% battery, and I got it 2 years ago.
Representative Miller. And members, we do have several testifiers.
We do have, yes, Mr. Chair, so we do have a few more testifiers.
But let's
testifiers.
Do these really quickly, and then we'll get all the other testifiers up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. And this is going to be brief. Representative Dean, and to the testifier, having a son who has autism, he's on the spectrum, and he's a teenager going into early adulthood. I think this is a good thing that we're doing. It's heading in the right direction. I can see ways in which this helps with it moving towards independent life and stuff like that, so thanks for doing this.
Well, Miller, this application is currently available free to the user. Feel free to sign your son up.
And we might give that a try. Thank you.
Fantastic. I'm learning all sorts of new things here today, Representative Dean. Why don't we bring up your other testifiers?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I believe you actually have to list in an order.
Well, let me do that.
I don't have that in front of me. So
Tim Leslie and Charlene Wilford, if you can both come forward. There are two seats that are available.
I'll write the list for you.
Mr. Chair, members, first off, Representative Dean, thank you so much for sponsoring this. Very important. I actually have a real-life example of how this helped a young lady find her way home one the summery day. We had a...
And Chief, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting. I need to get your name on
you
the
bet.
Record.
Yeah, it's Tim Leslie, Dakota County Sheriff.
Sheriff Leslie.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. So on June 18th of 18, we had a double fatal crash in Dakota County in the rural area, 190th and Goodwin, if you're interested in Googling. Very tragic. We had to shut the roads down for about 6 hours while the State Patrol came in and did the recon of that crash. Enter Caitlin into the circumstance. Caitlin is a cognitively delayed, impaired individual who has vitals, has the vitals app. She, on Sundays, her parents allow her to go to Walmart in Hastings, and she knows how to get there one way. She got to the roadblock, encountered a reserve deputy there from the Hastings Police Department, and expressed some confusion about what to do next. Was exasperated by being told that she had to turn around and go a different way. She pulled over and stopped and sat in her car. The reserve officer felt she was showing signs of impairment, which immediately drew the attention of one of the Dakota County Sheriff's deputies to come to his site and to see what he was encountering. As the reserve deputy arrived and saw the Hastings reserve officer encountering Caitlin, his cell phone went off with the Vitals app coming forward to say, you are encountering Caitlin, who has a mild cognitive disorder. Here's her mother and father's phone number. Here's how to talk to Caitlin safely so that she doesn't get more anxious than she already is. The deputy reviewed that information, walked up to Caitlin's car and says, hi, are you Caitlin? And immediately began that conversation to calm her down so that they could have a conversation. Caitlin, I'm Deputy Gonder, who's the deputy at the time that did this. I'm going to get you home safely. Are you okay with following me in my squad car? Absolutely. He next called her mom and dad, said, Caitlin's with me. I know she's been delayed in getting back to you, and we're going to get her home safely. So this was an encounter that was good, win-win, both sides of the equation. So we're super supportive. Dakota County, we're super progressive in acknowledging the use of technology to make us better. I testified earlier in Representative Lesh's committee about how we use drones to be more efficient, to clear accident scenes faster, crime scenes sooner. Vitals app was just the next thing we did that made sense for us to do. Every law enforcement agency except for one in Dakota County has the Vitals app, and mine is just one success story of many.
Thank you, Sheriff Leslie. It sounds it sounds like it's enhancing great law enforcement. Thank you for sharing that story. Welcome, Ms. Wilford.
Thank you.
And meanwhile, Ms. Angela Lockhart, if you can come forward, that would be great.
Hello, my name is Charlene Wilford. Hello, Councilman. My story is about the CARE Project and my son that is autistic with multiple different medical conditions with that. I believe this would help not only him, but multiple other children and adults, because when my child couldn't talk, he was out there, wandered off, and behind him not being able to talk, he couldn't communicate with no one. But now that we have the vitals, it's out there that they can ping him if he wanders off. He could, anything. It would help outstandingly. And please bring this bill, because all the children or adults that have this autism can't interact with us that do talk. This is our word for these children to have, be safe, okay? And as I'm a parent, this is a long time coming, and we need it. So please pass it and bring the money so that the training can be there for the officers, because they saved my son that could have been dead right now. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wilford. And I thank the presence of those law enforcement officers with your son as well. It sounds like the community is anxious to be able to receive this kind of training. So thank you for your testimony. Ms. Lockhart, and then Mr. Noah McCourt, if you could come forward. Meanwhile, that'd be terrific. Ms. Lockhart.
Chairman, thank you, representatives. My name is Angela Lockhart. I'm the Integrated Service Delivery Coordinator for Dakota County. My primary project is overseeing our Adult Detention Alternatives Initiative. And the purpose of ADAI is to promote better outcomes for individuals who frequently cycle in and out of jails, emergency rooms, hospitals, detox, other crisis services, by coordinating across systems and using data to inform our policies and our process. I'm here to testify in support of House File 377, which would appropriate the funds to train first responders on autism. How this bill supports the work that we're doing in Dakota County and other counties and jurisdictions across the state. Dakota County implemented ADAI in early 2016. We used data, research, partnerships, lessons from the field to better understand the depth and the breadth of the problem that we're encountering. For an example of the work that we've done, we utilized the evaluation report that was completed by the Office of the Legislative Auditor in 2016 to help ensure that we're using the best tools available to identify individuals with mental health when they show up in custody, and to ensure that we are providing the best resources and support available. To that end, that we hired a mental health coordinator who works in the jail. We are also, as Sheriff Leslie stated, the first county in Minnesota to implement vitals across nearly all of our cities. And we have also embedded a mental health professional in two of our cities in Dakota County, all different strategies to address individuals that are frequently encountering law enforcement who have mental health or substance use or other social welfare related needs. We know that the best way to support people is to have robust diversion options available and divert people who do not need to be in custody. proper training is certainly a diversion option. In the last 3 years of the ADAI work, we've come to understand that law enforcement is frequently called upon to respond to non-criminal matters, and that includes an increasing amount of the mental health calls. It's important for us that we collaborate with law enforcement and build capacity to respond to all the residents who encounter law enforcement who have disabilities or other mental health challenges. House File 377 provides another tool that will help us do this work. So people with autism are increasingly living and working in the community, and the encounters between first responders and people with autism have the propensity to go wrong. Without understanding autism or other mental health needs, first responders may misinterpret common characteristics. As Sheriff Leslie shared, the responding officer to the scene mistakenly thought that the driver, Caitlin, was impaired. And with the information available and training being able to spot the characteristics, that definitely goes a long way to being able to mitigate any negative outcomes. So in order to support more positive interactions, we feel that the training is very necessary to increase the knowledge, the awareness of autism, mental health conditions, and support our first responders in being able to do their jobs effectively. We know that the City of St. Paul is currently utilizing the CARE curriculum, and we love the success that it's had. We would ask that you support the bill and support the work, the amazing innovation spirit of Minnesota, and the work that's going on in all of the counties. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lockhart. Thank you for your work. Mr. McCourt, and then our last testifier that's scheduled is Robert Sink, if he can come forward and be ready to testify after. Oh, it's Officer Sink. All right, very well. Mr. McCourt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Noah McCourt. I am a disability advocate. I'm a member of the Governor's Council on Developmental Disability, and I have chaired the State Subcommittee on Children's Mental Health since early 2017. I also serve on the Board of Directors for the Minnesota Association of Children's Mental Health, but I'm also coming off a probationary sentence for something that was due to my disability of autism spectrum disorder, and it's more so in that capacity today that I want to testify in support of House File 377, not because it will fix my own situation, but because of my confidence it will address other situations in the future. I was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder at age 3, and in October 2016, my older brother attempted suicide in the Marine Corps. It stunned me, I became overstimulated, and I experienced what is referred to by most of my community as an autistic meltdown. I've trained myself in those situations to cut through a path in the woods along the Chaska River and go to my dad's church, which is exactly what I tried to do. Unfortunately, Chaska Police Department got called to conduct a welfare check on me, and in about under 5 minutes, I had been tackled, lost the tooth. I went into complete fight or flight mode and ended up in custody and being charged because I gave one of the cops a reddened knee. Like other stories, so often the cops had cited that they thought I was impaired. There was never a breathalyzer or a blood test or any sort of confirmation of that. It was simply on the training of what they've been trained to observe visually. My entire life, I've been told that I don't look autistic, that I'm too smart to be disabled, but my biggest disability as a person on the spectrum is invisible. In situations where I'm under duress, my ability to communicate shuts down. I cannot process verbal information. So what my parents did for me as a kid is they would often write things down, put it in front of me so I could process it at my own pace. And one of the interesting things is later as my dad reviewed the footage, he pointed out that I was engaging in a repetitive hand motion called stimming. And I was also rocking back and forth, both stereotypical signs of an overstimulated person with autism that if any sort of training or knowledge of autism had been present, could have been better and more easily identified. Another example I have of my experience with law enforcement is I recently had an example at MOA. I was waiting on the bus station. I was coming home from a political fundraiser, and I had someone who was impaired come up and kick me in the back of the head and try and take my phone charger. And it was just kind of my instinct, but I basically football tackled him. And all of a sudden, there were all these cops standing around, all these cops just everywhere. And that one of the officers recognized that I was starting to do my hand thing. What I'll often do is kind of like that. They sat me down. Talked to me in a way that I could process it at my own pace, but they also would write things down for me on paper and put it in front of me. They went out and got some like Mike and Ikes so that I could kind of just chillax, you know? that's even a word. That's just an extreme difference in the training that you see in St. Paul versus what you see from an untrained officer. The training really takes about an hour. I mean, it's not a very substantial training, but it makes all the difference. As my friend Jillian had said earlier, autism is skyrocketing Minnesota. I know she had mentioned the prevalence rates. Minnesota actually ranks second in national prevalence, right behind New Jersey, as far as autism spectrum disorder. With these rising prevalence rates, there's a variety of programs that are underway in several police departments across the country and around the world. But there are still too few and far in between. The scarcity of these programs is the unfortunate legacy of decades when autism was believed to be rare and where people such as myself lived out our lives in state-run institutions. We all know autism is common. We know it exhibits itself in every race and every shade of humanity. And isn't it time that we take action to give law enforcement officers the knowledge that they need to avoid a normal aspect of the job blowing up into an explosive situation? I would argue that by taking this action and advancing House File 377, we're saying exactly what Governor Luther Youngdahl said in the fall of 1949 as he stood in the courtyard of Anoka State Hospital and burned mechanical restraints. We say to the autism community that we understand them, that they have no fears, and that those around them are friends. I strongly encourage you to say to the autism community today that they are among friends and support House File 377.
Thank you, Mr. McCords, for your powerful testimony. I want to commend you, sir, for your successful and brave efforts to be a fully empowered and engaged citizen in our society as you live with your disability. And I love hearing quotes from Governor Youngdahl, so thank you for that as well. And members, I think we're all chillaxed here. So, Officer Zink, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Officer Robert Zink. I've been with the St. Paul Police Department for over 20 years as a police officer. We started the CARE Project in St. Paul due to having multiple police contacts with those in the autism community. That didn't turn out too well. We're dealing with a lot of internal affairs complaints. The actual program was started by then-Commander Paul Iovino, now Deputy Chief in St. Paul. We've been longtime friends. He came to me and said, hey, we're having issues here, and I understand with you having two boys on the autism spectrum, I don't understand this. We as law enforcement generally don't understand it. Rob, we need your input. And after reviewing those internal affairs complaints and meeting with the parents, we found out parents didn't understand what law enforcement was doing. Law enforcement didn't understand autism, and the people on the spectrum did not had a large fear of law enforcement. With that, my personal connection with having two boys on the spectrum, I'll just say my son Gabe is 13 years old. He's just about a half inch shorter than I am, and he's quite a little bit bigger than me. Well, I'm 250 pounds and 6'1". Gabe looks like he's 22 or 23. He's 13 years old, but he really has a mentality of a six-year-old. And it scares me, being a law enforcement officer, if Gabe is in a general public atmosphere without me or my wife being around, what would happen to him if there was some incident? I don't think it would turn out too well. And that scares me, to be honest. What I've learned doing this is not just strictly a law enforcement thing. It's also a parent thing. It's also a thing for the individuals on the spectrum. We've learned usually our initial contacts aren't perfect, and I don't expect them to be for officers. As many people have told me, if you met one person with autism, you met one person with autism. And with that being the case, our initial contacts in general aren't going to be perfect. So one thing we've learned by doing this in St. Paul is once we have that initial contact, we make sure we do a follow-up contact with them in a non-crisis situation. And we've learned by doing this, we've reduced the number of calls to those addresses, and then when we've had those return calls, our interactions have been far better. I can repeat 20 stories if they want to talk to after the fact, but there's been too many instances where we've taken kids who've had very much fear of the police officers and now turned it into that now where they're good friends. One of the things that's really improved for the St. Paul Police Department is, and I'll give you an example from last year, we had a new family move into St. Paul in March. The transition was a lot for the teenage daughter. And in the first 2 weeks she was in town, officers responded. We weren't real clear of that she was autistic or not. We weren't getting that information. And in those first 2 weeks she was in the city of St. Paul, she had already 3 mental health assessments and transports to the Regents Hospital. Fourth time I was called, I got to receive the information. We went from, the interaction was not going well, but when I was able to calm her down and try a few techniques, we were able to get her calmed down without having to go to the hospital, and we were able to find her some additional follow-up services and counseling that we weren't returning to that address. And so we hadn't received a call to that address for well over 6 months following the initial contact. The point of that for us in law enforcement is, especially the state, when many of these kids are on medical assistance, my hope is if we can train about 12,000 police officers in the state of Minnesota, if just once in their career, it reduces one ambulance ride to the state. And I know in St. Paul, it's roughly about a $2,000 bill to get an emergency transport. But just one time in any officer's career, it reduces that. You're talking $24 or $25 million just for one incident during one officer's career, if it could reduce it just once. In closing, most officers, after they've gone through the training, notice it's about an hour. That's just the response portion is about an hour. But the whole training involving behavior and interaction with communities is roughly a four-hour training. Most officers, because of our training we have in law enforcement, too many things that present in autism lead down a different path that 99% of our training has an inverse reaction, where usually in general law enforcement purposes has a positive reaction. And then when they've learned, they've seen these kind of things, they've learned that the different approach has led to less internal affairs complaints, it's led to less physical interactions, and it ends up being less return calls to those same addresses. I've been getting calls and contacts. We've had officers from Scotland come and see us. Literally yesterday afternoon, I was speaking to officers in Calgary, Alberta. Had multiple contacts to the United States. When they see the format and how it works, it's gotten relatively positive reviews.
Very well. Thank you, Officer Zink, for your testimony, and thank you for your service to my city of St. Paul. Are there any questions for the testifiers? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, Representative Dean. Too many times dealing with Representative Lesh between last night and today.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Johnson, I will take that as a compliment.
First of all, I want to thank you for taking my amendment. Wanted to make sure that we had the information before the next biennium, so if this program works, we could possibly continue it through that report. Then a couple different questions I have. One, we have a lot of departments, especially in greater Minnesota, that do not have department-issued phones. Mm-hmm. With this program, is that... I don't know how much data it takes up on that phone where the officers are actually paying for the program.
I'm going to have Jillian respond to the vital stuff, unfortunately.
And I'm wondering if it's going to cause issue with the phones. Data issues.
The application is Bluetooth powered, so it uses very minimal data. It's not necessarily like picking up something off of the internet where it requires a great amount of data. It's the actual Bluetooth system in the phone and the actual Bluetooth system in the card that computes. So it's a very, very minimal data usage.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, I appreciate that, but I know a lot of the guys that I worked with, we didn't use the Bluetooth. We did not have that capability turned on. It drains so much power when you're driving by, especially in greater Minnesota, because we don't have that much of it, that it
can you're talking more for the cell use or for the Bluetooth?
Even on the Bluetooth, we wouldn't have that on because it sometimes it creates some problems with the electronics of the car, but that might have changed.
I think it's also important to recognize that the bill does not indicate VITO specifically. So if a department doesn't have the use of department issue phones, they do have the option of exploring other technology. We're just creating a revenue stream that's going to allow them to utilize the supports and services that are out there to be more effective in serving the autism and other invisible disability community.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, I appreciate that. I think it's a great program, and it's something that can be used statewide, but there again, in greater Minnesota, if it wasn't Bluetooth, I was concerned about the lack of cell phone coverage and the lack of LTE. If it dealt on that base, it would not work too well. So I'm glad it's under the rather than on the Bluetooth, so it could work. And then the other thing on the bill on line 1.7, since this is a law enforcement-based program, I think you might want to look at changing emergency responders to law enforcement because they're the ones that are going to get that first call to decide whether to call an ambulance or some type of other type of service.
Officer Zink or Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, this was written specifically for training of officers, but we included the broader emergency responders. And if you think it would be more beneficial to actually adjust that, we certainly could do that, but as mentioned, this is just going to be laid over for possible inclusion, so we have a little bit of time to actually work on that.
And Representative Dean, I just want to make sure, I believe the way you've structured this approach is that this is a train-the-trainers effort, and as such, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later, markup our bill, you're really looking for a one-time appropriation. Am I correct or am I mistaken?
Mr. Chair, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, some of it is training some more trainers to work with officers, but ultimately we do know that there are costs associated with officers in the training of these types of programs. And, you know, as I previously asked a question regarding how many hours of sort of continuing education and training that officers have to go through every 3 years. We want to make sure that this is able to fit within that sort of allotment of hours that they dedicate towards this type of training.
Mr. McCourt just updated me that the bill was originally structured to include law enforcement officials, and when the Minnesota County Board signed on, Minnesota County Association signed on with support. They requested that we expand it because of enthusiasm for the program and what it could potentially create in as far as inclusion in our communities.
Thank you for that, Ms. Nelson. Representative Edelson and then Representative Christensen, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Chair. I want to say I'm a huge supporter of this legislation. I was really excited when I was reading it. We tried to bring this, I represent Edina, and we tried to bring this to our community, and we've been working on it. I serve on the crime fund there, and for the St. Paul officer, thank you so much for sharing your story, too. I think that understanding with the background, my background as a therapist, with understanding complexities of our behavior, it's really important that you have support in this, but thank you for leading for the rest of the state.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative, it was Considine, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an amazing thing, looking at that, not only does it identify, but tells you step by step how to approach the person. Do you see other applications? I mean, I'm a schizophrenic.
Do you want me to speak to it?
Yeah, you can speak to it.
The Vitals app, well, this is not, the bill's not specifically for it. It can be utilized for anyone that has information that they want to provide to law enforcement. I have a good friend of mine whose husband uses it. He's diabetic, and when his blood sugar crashes, he appears very intoxicated. He also enjoys a few drinks now and then. So his instructions very clearly say, ask me what 5 + 4 is. If I can't answer it, get me my insulin. If I can answer it, feel free to take me to detox.
That's a great application, yeah.
Very well. I want to thank the testifiers for an empowering conversation and an informational one as well, and certainly in keeping with our theme today of Mental Health and Neurodiversity Day. Representative Dean, you get the final word here before we move on.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. This is something that we can make better. By funding this training, we will help many, many different situations. And in the end, it makes those individuals who are impacted and those officers who interact with those who are impacted will actually make them safer. And last time I checked, we're still a public safety and criminal justice reform committee with safety being right there at the front of what we're doing. So I appreciate your support and would encourage you to consider it in the larger bill that will come out of our committee.
Thank you very much, Representative Dean. And so the chair will lay House File 377 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you to all the testifiers again. Representative Stevenson, House File 474. And I'm wondering if Representative Howard would be kind to move for you. The motion would be to lay over House File 474 for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair, I'll make that motion.
Terrific. Representative Howard moves House File 474. It is before us. Representative Stevenson, do you have an author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, there are two amendments, and I would accept both of them onto the bill.
Okay. Someone else. Okay. Very well. While I get my act together here, Representative Stevenson, the chair will move the A2 amendment, and this is, you've already indicated this is an acceptable amendment for you.
That's correct.
Very well. Members, basically what this amendment does is that it makes sure that the grant program that's being created here there's obviously a strong interest and a good head start on the part of Anoka County, but the idea here is to be consistent with past practices and make sure that it's made available on a competitive grant basis. So with that, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And then someone, is this not his? Okay. Why don't we wait for the bill presentation? Very well. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill deals with how, like I understand a number of bills you've been considering today, with how our criminal justice system interfaces with the mental health community and people with chronic mental illness. And I have been a prosecutor for Hennepin County for a number of years, and in that time I've also handled probation revocations for Hennepin County. And so I feel like I have a good basis to tell you that I think that the criminal justice system in Minnesota is failing people with chronic mental illness in really serious and consequential ways every single day. Our traditional criminal justice system is just frankly not particularly well equipped for the challenges in particular circumstances of people who are dealing with chronic mental illness. In Hennepin County, where I work, we've had a great deal of success dealing with specialty courts or treatment courts, and I know in fact there's a staff member in the room who has had great experience working with treatment courts in Hennepin County. But these courts allow people with specific expertise and specific knowledge to work on a daily basis with people confronting those challenges and have had great success in reducing recidivism rates and getting good outcomes in the criminal justice system. The question is, and that works well for Hennepin County, and it works well for Ramsey County, and it works well for a few other specific places around the state, but it isn't an approach that's going to work for every county, at least not right now. I would love it if every county in Minnesota could have a drug court and a mental health court, and as we do in Hennepin County, a DWI court and a vets court and all of the other great specialty courts that, we have. I would love that, but we're not there right now. What this bill does is allows Anoka County and one other county, at least one other county in the state, to develop specialized programs within their probation departments for people with mental illness. It will allow us to have probation officers who have specific expertise and training in dealing with mental illness to address those concerns, which I think will help us reduce recidivism rates and get better outcomes for not just people with mental illness who are involved in the criminal justice system, but for our community as a whole. I think that there is broad consensus, I would hope there's broad consensus, that having a mental illness shouldn't be a crime, and that you shouldn't spend more time in jail just because you're mentally ill. And unfortunately, the facts on the ground are right now that that's happening. And this is a chance to, get at that problem. And I have a couple testifiers here that can speak to that, can speak to that experience, and also what, in particular, in Anoka County, they are looking forward to doing. If the chair will briefly entertain me, though, NAMI had hoped to be here. They have a number of bills as we approach deadline that they are taking a stance on today, but they are in support of this bill, and they provided me with a letter that, if the chair permits, I would read and read to the committee members. It's
very well, brief. Representative Stevenson.
It says, "Dear Representative Stevenson, NAMI Minnesota strongly supports House File 474. We know that when someone with mental illness is struggling with their symptoms, they are more likely to violate their parole. A 2005 study from the Department of Justice found that 75% of incarcerated individuals with a mental health diagnosis have been arrested before. A 2017 study showed offenders with diagnoses have a 9% greater chance of rearrest 1 year after release. 5 years after release, the difference increases to 15%. The same 2017 study found that people with severe diagnoses are 4% more likely to be rearrested than those with milder conditions. Amy Blank Wilson of the Mandel School of Applied Social Sciences examined recidivism rates for 20,112 inmates admitted to the Philadelphia jail system in 2003. After 4 years, they found that 54% for people with severe mental illness, 60% with those with no diagnosis, 66% for those with substance abuse problems, and 68% for those with co-occurring mental illness and substance abuse. We know through the Stepping Up initiatives in Minnesota and around the country that using multidisciplinary approaches, breaking down the silos, leads to better care, more efficient use of resources, and better outcomes. And we are pleased to have the opportunity to support this bill." So thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I turn it over to my testifiers.
Very well. Please welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Representative Stevenson, appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Corey Cohan. I work with Anoka County Community Corrections. I'm a manager over the adult probation and supervised release services area, as well as our adult work release facility. And as a employee of Anoka County, I'm very pleased to work for a jurisdiction that is concerned about innovation and being progressive and doing what works, and really using research-driven data decisions to make policy. And so I'm here to support this bill and tell you a little bit about what we envision if this was to move forward. House File 474 seeks to improve public safety and behavioral health outcomes for people with mental illness under community supervision. The bill establishes a pilot project in Anoka County and at least one or more jurisdictions through a grant process. The jurisdictions would then develop a multidisciplinary caseload team that would be comprised of a probation officer and a adult mental health social worker or a community provider, depending upon the jurisdiction, that would target high-risk adult offenders with mental illness who are under probation, supervised release, or pretrial supervision. Correctional clients with mental illness, many of whom have co-occurring substance abuse disorders, are unfortunately overrepresented in the criminal justice settings, particularly in jails and prisons, as Representative Stevenson mentioned and the NAMI letter alluded to. But estimates anywhere between 14 and 16% of individuals in the criminal justice system suffer from a serious or persistent mental illness. And as you look at the populations incarcerated, those numbers are even higher. This population, as you can imagine, creates significant community supervision, case management, and resource challenges for both justice and behavioral health professionals. Correctional and mental health client needs are increasingly intersecting, necessitating greater collaboration and integrated case management approaches to reduce duplication of services, which often occurs, and improve efficiency. And as we've heard earlier in testimony on previous bills and from statements that were already made here, that oftentimes we have clients that are in both systems, and we have multiple workers working on the same cases and duplicating services, and sometimes in conflict with one another in terms of priorities and resources, et cetera. We know that many of these individuals struggle with symptom and behavioral management, and they're susceptible to forms of noncompliance on supervision, resulting in technical violations, arrest, and incarceration. Many of these folks struggle making appointments, showing up at their probation officer's meetings, testing positive for mood-altering chemicals, sometimes because they're self-medicating symptoms, failing out of programming, et cetera. And so these folks tend to be disproportionately rearrested and face revocation. It is estimated that individuals with mental illness under supervision are more likely to fail supervision and twice as likely as those without a mental illness to have their supervision revoked. So a disproportionate number of folks being reincarcerated due to symptoms that are unmanaged in the community. While mental illness alone does not typically drive criminality, and I want to be really clear about that, that we believe and the research suggests that mental illness does not create criminal behavior. It is a condition, though, that makes compliance with court orders, rules, expectations very difficult for some folks to comply with. These folks struggle with housing, supportive relationships, use of mood-altering chemicals, and when symptoms are not managed, there's opportunities for increased risk to the community and also risk to self-harm or others. So with functioning impairment challenges, it's difficult for these folks to navigate the system, to respond to our interventions, and may affect their ability to, as I mentioned, to maintain employment and be stable in the community. But we also know from looking at some of the research that just managing symptoms and stabilizing folks alone is not necessarily enough to improve criminal justice outcomes. And so what we're proposing here is a more of an integrated model that coordinates services between two different delivery systems, the social services or adult mental health system and the correctional system. And that way you're targeting both the symptoms of mental health and also the risk factors for recidivism, which are a little bit different, things like criminal thinking, substance abuse, poor family relationships, et cetera. As Representative Stevenson indicated, traditionally these folks have been managed on traditional larger caseloads, just kind of lumped in with everybody else on your caseload, and not really getting specialized attention, agents or probation agents not having expertise or specialized training to work with these populations. And so they didn't get the extra attention that they need, which in this model they would. As he also indicated, their mental health treatment courts are a great tool, a great strategy. However, some jurisdictions simply don't have the ability, the resources, or the stakeholder investment or a commitment to make those things happen. So this would be an alternative model to a mental health treatment court. So in closing, I just wanted to kind of summarize what some of our primary objectives of the initiative would be and goals that we would hope to achieve in this initiative. First of all, we would be looking forward to specialized and smaller caseload sizes. This would be a multidisciplinary team of corrections professional and social services professional, ideally maybe 15 to 25 clients per staff member. So you could be with a two-staff team, you could be getting to 30 to 50 clients perhaps to give them specialized attention. We hope to expedite mental health assessment, diagnosis, and access to treatment services, which are difficult for some of these folks to manage on their own without more assistance. We'd coordinate case management service between corrections and mental health providers, improve medication and treatment compliance. work on improved discharge planning following incarceration, and hopefully reduce duplication of services with the ultimate goal of reducing technical violations, revocation, arrests, and ultimately recidivism. But I would be remiss if I did not also say here that the goal also is to improve the client's quality of life too. So this is not just about criminal justice outcomes, but this is also about individual outcomes for folks who are suffering in the community, who happen to be caught up in the system and need help to navigate it and hopefully leave it permanently. So we appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I thank you all for your time. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Kohan. And we have another testifier. Please state your name for the record, sir.
Yes, sir. Tim Barry, Barry. I thank you, Chair Mariani, the representatives, members of the community. I want to thank Mr. Stevenson for asking me to testify today. I would like to open with a little excerpt from the book's called Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. It's a source of great complaint with the sheriffs and jailers that they must receive such persons. They have found no suitable accommodations for them, wrote minister-turned-prison reform Reverend Louis Dwight. Louis Dwight wrote this in 1820. I thought when I started fighting this, I thought I was onto something new. We've been fighting this over 150 years. I would just like to read my daughter's story. When I came down here in January, I brought, along with that petition, I brought this letter. And I really didn't know how to testify today, so I'm just going to read my daughter's letter to y'all. The treatment of the mentally ill in our state in and of itself is a crime. This comes from a sergeant at the Crow Wing County Jail. The Department of Human Services slams the door on us. This was a statement from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Tim, I know your daughter fell through our safety net. My response, Claire, what safety net? I know, Tim, there is none. That from Department of Human Services Commissioner Claire Wilson. Tim, your daughter is the poster child for a broken system. This from Julie J. in the Department of Human Services. There is a hole between criminal justice and the Department of Human Services that people fall into and cannot get out. What is a father to do hearing these things from a system which I thought was designed to protect the vulnerable in our society? These are just a few of the things I've heard over the last 4 years trying to get my daughter help. My walk from Clay County, from the Clay County Courthouse to the Capitol in April, accomplished nothing more than to me get two pant sizes smaller. Early May, I hand-delivered and signed 202 letters to every senator, representative, governor. Response was absolutely none that led me to this point. And that was in November when I started a petition and took it to all the courthouses I could get to law enforcement, to sheriffs, police chiefs, jail administrators. I traveled around Minnesota from county to county whenever I could between work with the enclosed petition, speaking with sheriffs, police chiefs, public defenders, and public signatures. The response was tremendous. Out of every county I've been to, only two sheriffs have not signed. And that was Otter Tail and Clay County, and that was because that's where my daughter's been incarcerated, Clay County and Otter Tail County, and I understand them not signing. But they told me, keep going anyway. Every other sheriff says, keep going, something needs to be done. Cassie's story, bipolar. She was diagnosed bipolar at 15. Addict for years, and at the age of 26, had a massive frontal lobe stroke, traumatic brain injury, along with the amputation of her right leg due to the stroke. Since that time, I've been trying to get Cassie help wherever possible. Basically, the only place she has been is prison and jail, maybe a treatment center here and there. While in prison, she received her prosthetic leg and was beginning to walk. The inmate stole the remote control to her leg, flushed it down the toilet, leaving her leg inoperable. She's been back in a wheelchair for 3 years. The prison sent her leg to Essentia Health in Fargo, North Dakota to be repaired. Essentia Health repossessed my daughter's leg for non-payment because while you're incarcerated, Social Security disability does not cover. She lost her leg twice, in essence. What psychological damage did that do along with the stroke and the TBI? When she's in jail and prison because of the brain damage and lack of impulse control due to the stroke and bipolar, she spends most of her time in solitary confinement. What further damage does that do? Cassie currently sits in the Clay County Jail awaiting trial. Why? Let me tell you. In August of this last year, 2018, she went to Tapestry, a dual diagnosis center here in St. Paul, to help her with the addiction, the bipolar, and the stroke. She was there a couple weeks when her and her roommate got in a fight over a pillow. My daughter threatened to kick her with her one leg. They kicked my daughter out for the exact behavior she was there to treat. She came back to Fergus Falls where probation and parole put a warrant out for her arrest for non-completion of treatment. She called the Fergus police to come and get her. By the time they got there, she had taken some of her medications. I think it was a mood stabilizer that also put you to sleep. She took too many of them, and by the time the cops got there, she was drowsy and out of it, and so they couldn't take her to jail. They took her to Clay County Detox, where after 2 days, someone left the front door open. She wheeled herself out onto the elevator and out the door. They found her across the street, wheeled her back in. In the process, Cassie hit an orderly. They charged her with felony escape and two assault charges and took her to jail where she incurred two more assaults on correctional staff. Now she sits with five charges. My daughter has never received the help that she has needed since the stroke from Clay County Social Services, Minnesota Department of Human Services, or any other entity in the state of Minnesota. It's a sad statement of the mentally ill in the state of Minnesota. The only help we have is prison and jail. 60% of prison inmates have some form of mental illness. This is but a minuscule part of Cassie's story. I am sure one story that could be told by families across the state. Myself, along with the undersigned, talking about the petition, are calling for the state legislature, along with the governor, to address the abuse of the mentally ill in our state. From my perspective, if an individual treated a vulnerable adult, or mentally ill person the way the state treats them, they themselves would be jailed. Time has come for criminal justice and human services reform in our state so people and families can get the help they need and stop the suffering. This comes from a policy paper written by the Supreme Court Administrators of the United States, decriminalization of mental illness, fixing a broken system. When mental illness is a factor in lawlessness and the fact is ignored, the result can be unproductive recycling of the perpetrator through the criminal justice system with dire consequences to us all. Chief Judge Judith S. K. My daughter has been through hell in this state. And she sits in an 8x10 cell today in solitary confinement with bipolar, stroke, and an amputation. If we had a mental health court with people who could help her. My daughter got out of prison 4 years ago. Probation and parole put her in. They called me and they said, what does your daughter need? I said, my daughter needs a group home. My daughter needs treatment. They released my daughter to an apartment in Dilworth, Minnesota, on the second floor, no elevator. She's in a wheelchair. She lasted probably 2 months. And the place they put her was owned by a couple of police officers from Moorhead that was felon friendly. So the system needs to be fixed. What Representative Stevenson is introducing is outstanding. I agree wholeheartedly with the other testifier over here. Everything he said, I ditto. The mentally ill are not to be disposed of. But that's what we do. We lock them up and we forget about them. That needs to end in our state. Minnesota needs to be a state of leaders. We need to be a leader in the mental health treatment, not followers. We need to be a leader, and we can do it. We just need to put our heads together, pass bills like Representative Stevenson is introducing, along with many others. We need to end solitary confinement for the mentally ill. They deserve better. They deserve better. But the problem is we have no beds. There are no beds for the mentally ill. What beds do we got? We closed the mental health. We closed the state hospitals because we didn't want people institutionalized, I believe. Well, guess what? Now they're institutionalized without the help they need. I was a chaplain out at the state pen in North Dakota. I've looked in that food slot of the mentally ill. I've seen the feces smeared on the walls. When that young man went in that cell, he wasn't in that shape. A month later, he's smearing feces on the wall. We need to treat our mentally ill better. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berry. You and I have spent some time, and you've shared, there's more to this, you've shared with me not just how your daughter has suffered, but also your entire family. And as someone who's also a father and a grandfather, I recognize the deep love and perseverance that you are about, sir. And you certainly have more than my well wishes. You have my commitment to act for good public policy so that we don't continue to perpetuate this kind of reality for our beloved sons and daughters in our state. Thank you, Chairman.
This, I forgot, this is my daughter, Cassie, wheelchair, stroke victim, bipolar, sitting in an 8x10 cell. These two little girls here, I got her out of prison. Cassie had her a month before her stroke. I've been raising these two their entire lives now. There's personal faces behind a mental illness.
Indeed.
And there they are.
Thank you, Mr. Berry.
Thank you, guys.
Representative Stevenson, we are a little bit over time. So members, I did misspeak when I talked about the A2 amendment. The A2 amendment. The language in the bill still remains with Anoka County identified. What that amendment did was expand to another site. And my hope is that we're able to do that with a greater Minnesota site because clearly, as we heard from the testimony, that this is a reality across the state. The state, that will be a competitive grant process. Representative Stevenson, you and I will continue to have this conversation because it certainly has been our practice in the past to have these be structured as competitive grant processes. Representative Johnson, do you have an A1 amendment?
Chair Mariani, I do have the A1 amendment. What it does is it expands the reporting to the legislature and the Department of Corrections. I think it's needed so we can actually get the information. Without it, we wouldn't hear what's going on.
Representative Stevenson?
It's a good idea. I'd accept the amendment. I thank Representative Johnson for offering it.
Thank you, then. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Johnson.
It's a couple things. One is I see there's an appropriation. I'm just wondering if I had an idea how much appropriations they were seeking.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I understand that the concept in Anoka County as a, and correct me if I'm wrong, was $200,000 a year, so a $400,000 cost for what Anoka County has proposed. So we'd be probably seeking $400,000 a year, $800,000 for the biennium.
A couple more things on this bill, if I may.
Please. And members, I do want to get to Chair Lesch's House File 1057. There is some informal agreement with both sides of the aisle on this bill. Chairman Lesch has a committee this evening, and so I don't want to have to drag him back here. So we can probably, rather, if we can get to that quickly, my hope is to do that. Representative Johnson.
I just wanted to bring up the fact I understand where this goes, and law enforcement has been dealing with this issue for years. It's unfortunate the amount of waste, fraud, and abuse in HHS that they started shutting facilities down that law enforcement desperately needed. I'm hoping that this current administration in HHS will look at the waste and the abuse and the fraud so we can get the beds we need for law enforcement to actually help these people.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Miller? Yes, very well, then. Representative Stevenson, last quick words.
I can't really add more than what was said before by Mr. Berry and others. It's a chronic problem. This is what I would call a small step in the right direction, but an important step.
Thank you for bringing us this bill, and thank you, Anoka County, for your envisioning work, and thank you, Mr. Berry, for your testimony. With that, the chair then lays over House File 474 as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And members, Representative Lesch moves House File 1057 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Lesch, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I think I've got someone up here with me. Is anyone going to be up here with me? No? Okay.
You're winging it, man.
I can't.
You got this.
I can't even remember who gave this to me, Mr. Chair. But it's a good idea.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, once in a while we admit things on the record. Mr. Chair, so this bill, House File 1057, is a further extension of the efforts of expungement that we first initiated in 2013, and which has been very successful. One of the reasons why we initiated that is the expanding list of collateral consequences that people have suffered as a result of being not just convicted, but charged. So back in the day when you received a conviction, there was petty misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony, it had various consequences. Well, these days, you can suffer consequences just from being charged with something that you're not guilty of. It may be very apparent that you're not guilty of it. That is an issue. And in order to purge those records, that includes police reports or various other charging instruments that would identify you as a criminal, even though you were not, you have to go through the expungement process. So what this bill does is it says that the prosecutor has to provide notice to the court when charges are dismissed as a result of mistaken identity or the person using the identifying information is a result of identity theft. So this is one of those situations I talked about where the reason why you were charged with it is because your identity was stolen. So this says that you're not subject to the requirements under that Chapter 299C, that they don't have to be destroyed if the person committed a felony or gross misdemeanor in the preceding 10 years. That's our window where we enhance as well. That's hence the 10 years. 10 years enhancement period for DWIs, for domestic assaults, for a list of crimes. I think there's pretty much broad consensus on this, that if someone stole your identity and committed a crime, you shouldn't have to deal with the system in that way. And I think there's broad agreement with it. I don't know if anyone's – is anyone going to argue against it? You're not going to argue against it. Okay, good. I think we're good then.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Lesh, I want to thank you for this. I've dealt in my career with people dealing with this issue of identity theft, having to prove things over and over and over again, 20 years after the theft occurred. So I'm highly in favor of this. And to go along with the bill earlier today that had the false identification, that's why I have an issue with that bill, because of the identity theft issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh. Wow, that is loud. I like the bill.
Gotcha.
And as somebody who works in the cybersecurity industry, I hear a lot of stories of people who, because they're really lazy with password management or other things, get taken advantage of. So I appreciate this bill. It's going to help some folks who, because they're not paying attention to some of the things that they should be, and they get their identity stolen, this is going to help them. So thanks.
Thank you.
Very well. Final words, Representative Lesh?
It's a good bill. I ask for your support, Mr. Chair.
Super.
Members, thank you.
Thank you. With that, the Representative Lesh, the Chair lays over House File 1057 for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And members, we will recess. We're doing a call?
Yes.
Call the Chair. For after session, we will meet in room 300 South, and we still have, we only have two bills. So hopefully that'll be a short,
Mr. Chair,
convening, and look for your emails. Representative,
I'm sorry, 200 doesn't have a South.
I'm sorry, 300 South.
You can sit on the South
side. With that, we stand and recess.
First?
Yeah.
Very well. The committee will, the Committee of Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will reconvene. Representative Dean has House File 705, and Representative Dean, you move to have House File 705 laid over for inclusion in your omnibus bill. So your bill is before us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House 705. Clarifies in statute that upon the individual receiving a pardon extraordinary, that their record is actually sealed. I think that most people are under the general understanding that that's the intent of the pardon, but over the many past years, that's become a little bit unclear. And you know, to clarify that. You know, pardon still allows judicial proceedings or in licensing process for peace officers. So although a record is sealed, there are opportunities when that record could be used. This really came to my attention a few years ago when I was told that I might want to check my history and possibly apply for an expungement. And so I ran a copy on my record, and my record came up blank, but we know that many people that had received pardons in the past would also have to apply for expungement. So I think this will clarify it, it will make it easier, and just, you know, so that the members know what magnitude we're talking. In 2015, there were 18 pardons granted. In 2016, there were 15 pardons granted. 2017, there were 13 pardons granted. And in 2018, there were 16 pardons that were granted. And anywhere from roughly one-third to one-half of the applicants actually received the pardons. It's a pretty intensive process that individuals that have been convicted of offenses in the past apply for. And as a reminder, you can't apply for it if you've been convicted of a crime of violence until 10 years has elapsed since your since your sentence has expired, and for nonviolent offenses, it's 5 years after your sentence has expired. So I would just ask that members consider this to be laid over for possible inclusion. I think it's a great bill, and we should all move forward with it.
Very well. Are there any questions for Representative Dean? If not, then Representative Dean, is there anyone that wishes to testify at House File 705? If not, then Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 705 be laid over. Actually, the chair lays over House File 705 for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Dean moves that House File 1717 be laid over for inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill. And Representative Dean, House File 1717 is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 1717 addresses the issues around mandatory life sentence without possibility parole for juveniles. And we know that in the past few years there have been some Supreme Court decisions regarding that. And I could go on at some length, but what I'd like to do is actually turn this over to a testifier who has been very patiently following this as it went from one committee hearing to another committee hearing, and now to this committee hearing. So if we could have the testifier come up, I would greatly appreciate it. And I'm not going to leave completely, but I am going to go in and check in the conference committee.
Can I ask you a question real quick? Sure. There's a DE-1 amendment here.
Yes, there is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is this your amendment, I take it?
Yes.
All right. What amendment?
No.
I just want to make sure. Is it audio numbers or not?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, that was offered because we continued to have conversations with some folks, and we felt that getting the language right was as important as anything else, and we believe that the DE-1, the author's amendment, actually gets the bill in the shape that we want it.
Very well.
Moving forward.
Representative Dean moves the DE-1 amendment. Discussion? Representative Post. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to my world.
A world of confusion?
Yeah.
That's Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, would you please explain your amendment?
And basically, Representative Dean, that's explaining the bill since it's doing everything.
Sorry, I I'm hoping it's in here. It is. Look at that.
We also have legal counsel here.
Right. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Grossel, the changes that are made are related to juveniles that have been convicted of life sentences without parole. And what this does for those individuals who were 18 years or younger at the time of the commission offense, that they're not given supervised release under the section until they've served a minimum of 25 years. And we made some changes in here relative to address the two different types of juveniles that receive life sentences without parole, one being certified as an adult and the other one as a judge making the decision, not with the certification but just as part of sentencing. So there's really sort of two things, and I believe that the DE-1 amendment makes that possible. And what I would add is, you know, the reason this bill is before us is because of the two Supreme Court rulings that has made it not constitutional for states to impose those types of penalties for juveniles without parole, life sentence without parole.
Is that
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Dean, you have a testifier who has waited for quite a while.
I think, Mr. Chair, she should get some extra credit for her
business.
So I'll turn it over to her, and I'm going to run real quick so I can get back, because I want to hear some of it, too.
Very well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Perry Moriarty. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. I teach criminal law, juvenile law, co-direct the child advocacy and Juvenile Justice Clinic, and among other things, our clinic represents juveniles charged with delinquency offenses and juveniles serving life sentences. Either it used to be life without parole sentences, they are now life sentences. And my research focuses in these areas as well. As you may recall, I provided testimony before this committee last week on brain maturation and the developmental differences between adolescents and adults. I'm here today to provide background on this bill, HF 1717, a bill that in many respects is the product of a lot of what I talked about last week. HF 1717 amends specific provisions of Minnesota's Heinous Crimes Act as they apply to juvenile defendants. In their current form, these provisions require courts to sentence youth convicted of aggravated homicide to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And they have been unconstitutional since 2012, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case called Miller versus Alabama. As we sit here today, there is no legislative authority in place in this state governing sentences of juveniles convicted of aggravated homicide. HF 1717 remedies this. It abolishes the sentence of life in prison without the possibility of release for juvenile defendants and replaces it with a sentence of life in prison with eligibility for release after 25 years. It also applies retroactively. These reforms are necessary to bring the Heinous Crimes Act into compliance with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Miller versus Alabama, and they are an important first step in aligning Minnesota with the more than 20 other states that have reformed their juvenile sentencing laws in response to this seminal decision. Before discussing the Supreme Court cases that have given rise to this bill, I want to say a few words about the sentence of life without parole for juveniles. The United States is currently the only country in the world that imposes this sentence on children. Indeed, the International Convention on the Rights of the Child bans the sentence. This country and Somalia are the only two countries that have not signed on to this convention. Life without release for both children and adults is a punishment that became far more prevalent in this country beginning in the 1980s. During the get-tough super-predator era of the 1990s, its use for juveniles rose exponentially. By 2012, more than 2,500 juveniles were serving mandatory life without release sentences in this country, and another 9,000 were serving discretionary or functional life without release sentences across the country. We know that more than 75% of those sentenced to life without release are children of color. 60% of them are African-American children. Research also tells us that the majority of these adolescents have experienced highly elevated levels of poverty, community violence, and familial incarceration. Most have diagnosed learning differences, educational delays, and suffer from profound mental health challenges. We know that the average life expectancy for juveniles sentenced to life without release is 50.6 years. Finally, we know that the majority of these adolescents have committed very serious offenses. And in a number of cases, they have committed acts that took another person's life. Acts that had and continue to have a devastating impact on families and communities. This is also true. No one disputes that. And nothing in my testimony today, nothing in this bill is intended to minimize these acts or these losses. Now to the law. Over the last 15 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has issued four seminal decisions about juvenile sentencing that have impacted the ability of states like Minnesota to impose the harshest sentences in this country on children. In 2005, in Roper versus Simmons, the Supreme Court banned the death penalty for those under 18. In 2010, in Graham versus Florida, the Supreme Court banned life without release for juveniles who had not committed homicide. In 2010, Miller versus Alabama, it banned life without release for juveniles when it is imposed in a mandatory fashion. And in 2016, in Montgomery versus Louisiana, the court held that Miller should apply retroactively to the more than 2,500 inmates who were serving mandatory sentences around the country, and clarified that only the rarest of juveniles, those who were found to be, quote unquote, irretrievably corrupt, should be sentenced to die in prison. An increasingly sophisticated body of knowledge about the adolescent brain served as the foundation for all four decisions. In each opinion, the Supreme Court emphasized that three fundamental features of youth, lack of maturity, vulnerability to negative influences, and capacity for change, make children, quote, constitutionally different from adults and, quote, less deserving of the most severe punishments. I'm going to turn to some slides that have been printed out for your reference. I believe the TV isn't quite working. It is the Supreme Court's decision in Miller versus Alabama that is the reason for the bill before you. Miller invalidated sentencing statutes in 28 states, including Minnesota. And that would be slide two. You can't quite see it on this printout, but these are graphics indicating the 28 states in the country that were required to amend their unconstitutional juvenile sentencing laws after Miller in 2012. And the next slide chose the six states that have failed to do so, and Minnesota is one of the six. 21 states, on the next slide, now ban the sentence of life without release for juveniles completely. And several of those are our neighbors. Five additional states have no one serving the sentence at all. So more than half the states in this country either ban this sentence or have no one serving. 15 states and the District of Columbia have banned the sentence in just 5 years, from North Dakota to Nevada to Arkansas to Utah, West Virginia, Wyoming, Texas to South Dakota. These legislative reforms have been geographically diverse and strongly bipartisan. In fact, in two-thirds of the states that have banned this penalty in just the last 5 years, Republicans have authored or sponsored two-thirds of these bills. 13 states, these bills have passed with over 80% support. The median sentence nationwide for juveniles whose sentences have been altered is 25 years, and I give you a sample of some legislative schemes in other states. In Minnesota, bills have become before the House, the Senate, or both bodies in the last 7 years, but none have passed. In part, this is because in certain years, committees simply haven't had the bandwidth to hear them. Because of this, in 2017, the MSBA, the Minnesota State Bar Association, appointed a bipartisan committee of stakeholders, legislators, and academics to address the unconstitutionality of this juvenile sentencing bill. I was a member of that commission, as were Representative O'Neill, Representative Lesh, Justice Anderson, who you heard from yesterday, John Kingery, many of the members of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and members of the Public Defender. The Commission on Juvenile Sentencing for Heinous Acts issued a very long report that Representative O'Neill currently has custody of. It is about 4 inches thick. And the report urges the legislature to act, to bring this statute into compliance. This is the legislature's quintessential role. We have an unconstitutional statute. It should not be up to the Minnesota Supreme Court to fill in the holes. It's up to this body. MSBA has submitted a letter to this committee. I believe everyone has a copy, attesting and urging the legislature to act. The reforms in this bill will bring Minnesota into compliance. As I said, it eliminates the sentence of life without release. It's something that organizations like the American Bar Association, American Probation and Parole Association, and the American Correctional Association have all urged states to do. It would replace this term with eligibility for release after 25 years. It would apply prospectively and also retroactively to the 8 individuals who were sentenced to mandatory life without parole as juveniles. It would also apply prospectively to juvenile sentences of life with eligibility for release after 30 years. These would now carry eligibility after 20 years. So those sentences are the second highest penalty in the state currently, and it cannot be that the highest level penalty has eligibility for release at 25 years, while the second highest has eligibility at 30 years. So that would come down as well. Finally, none of these reforms guarantee release for anyone. They simply present an opportunity. They simply reflect our collective recognition that despite what they did, the individuals that we're talking about were still children when they did it. And for that reason, we should not sentence them to die in prison. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Moriarty. Are there any questions? Professor Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, our Representative Dean, may have taken until 8 o'clock at night, but you and I have agreed on two things in one day, so mark this as a really good day. I do support this, and I know that this was worked on a little bit in the last couple of years with my good friend Kathy Lohmer, I think it makes sense, and I think the reason why you see bipartisan, sometimes you have things from different angles, but we arrive at the same location, and maybe there's a lot of similar things, there might be some differences, but I think the important thing is that we all agree that these are children, and we need to be looked at differently. I do have a brief question, and my question's simple. I don't mean to make this into a long answer, so if you can give it to me briefly, just educate me a little bit on the point at which they may be released, kind of what that, you know, the only parole board I've seen was in Shawshank Redemption, and I don't think that that was probably an accurate reflection. So can you just give me an abbreviated version of what this looks like so that I can have kind of clear in my mind that this is, I know it's a sober review, but you get where I'm going at. If you can just give a little bit of an indication. That's right.
Professor Moriarty.
Representative Miller. The answer is that currently our law provides for the Commissioner of Corrections to perform that review. So eligibility would happen after 25 years. The individuals would start preparing for that release eligibility a few years in advance, hopefully looking at reentry possibilities. But the reality historically has been that the Commissioner does the review, and I don't know what the current statistics are on our release rates at first eligibility, but I don't believe they're high. The average around the country is about 8% release for juveniles at first eligibility.
Okay, thank you.
I think the answer is going to be shorter.
Mm-hmm. Professor Moriarty, would you, I know nothing about this area, but would you anticipate, given the population, that the inputs and the considerations that the finder, in this case would be the Commissioner of Corrections, that would change or should change? What would evidence and science say should be considered that would be different from other populations?
The answer is yes, and many other states that have taken the step to ban this punishment and create eligibility after a term of years have also amended their parole release statutes in several ways. One way is that they have altered the composition of their parole boards to include experts on things like adolescent brain development.
No, something weird was going on. It's annoying me. I don't know if it's annoying others. I'm sorry.
And the reason for that is that there are two forms of inquiry here. One is, how culpable was the child at the time of the offense? What things were going on in the child's life in addition to the still developing brain that had its own normative deficits? Were there extra pressures on the home front? Was the child exposed to extraordinary violence? Was he peer pressured, et cetera? So that calculus would go into play to assess culpability at the time of the offense. Obviously, the factors that we are all familiar with, the gravity of the offense, the effect on the victim and the victim's family would come into play as well. But the record of rehabilitation would matter as well, and this is yet another form of criteria. When a 17-year-old is sentenced to a life term in prison, there are psychological and emotional impediments that adults whose brains are fully developed don't encounter. I've talked to a lot of these young men, and when you enter prison and are told that you will likely die there, the mental calculus is something very different than it would be if you had a prospect for hope on the other end. So someone who understands the trajectory of the record, understands that for a 17-year-old in prison facing initially, before we had this resentencing process and these laws were changed, facing certain death in prison, those few years are going to be bumpy. Be able to read a record to understand why that would be, to understand why that would not necessarily mean they were a threat, why it would be that after age 25, a prison record looks entirely different. So a piece of it would be the expertise on the parole board, but it would also be the parole release criteria. West Virginia is actually a state that has taken a lead in this area, and its parole criteria have been amended to reflect the calculus that will need to go in at first eligibility. I hope that answers the question.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And obviously that aligns with the three reasons that the Supreme Court found in those series of reforms, if you will, in terms of those four litigated cases, maturity, vulnerability, and prospect for change. Very well. Representative Grasso, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Professor Moriarty, did I hear you say that there is eight that it would retroactively affect?
Yes, please, Professor.
Chair Moriarty, Representative Russell. Yes, with a caveat. So there were eight individuals originally serving mandatory life without release sentences, and five have already been resentenced under a Minnesota State Supreme Court decision 2016 called Jackson versus State. That said, because the legislature hadn't yet acted, the Minnesota Supreme Court was going to do something called statutory revival to bring back an old law, flop it in place until the legislature had acted. And it mandated that those who had committed single-victim offenses be resentenced to 30 to life. The question then is what happens with the remaining three of the eight who had multiple victims. One individual had three victims, and he has been resentenced to 90 years to life. and the remaining two remain in post-conviction litigation to determine whether, depending on what happens here, whether their sentences are concurrent 30-year-to-life sentences or consecutive 30-to-life sentences, which would be 60 years to life. So even though this legislation would apply retroactively, my sense is that it would convert the 30-to-life sentences to 20-to-life sentences and would, in full disclosure, what other states have actually done when they have come up with a scheme like this is they've actually capped all juvenile punishments at a particular term of years, so you don't have that consecutive offense problem. That's not a place we could get to this year, but it's something that I believe we'll discuss further down the line, and we've actually had a very good working relationship from all constituents and all stakeholders on both sides of the proverbial courtroom aisle. And I do believe that we will be able to make inroads there, but what will happen, I think, is those sentences will be converted, and with the 90 to life and 60 to life, it would then presumably be 75 to life and 50 to life.
Thank you. Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Grassl actually asked one of my questions, but the other one is, I mean, this is, I'm Chair, like you, this is new to me. I guess I'm trying to understand the scenario with, like, the youngest child that this has actually occurred with, and I'm wondering if you can give me, like, a case study, like somebody that we can all kind of understand from a child's perspective what this looks like.
Professor Mariani.
Chair Mariani, Representative Adelson. I can give you a case study in that my clinic actually does represent the youngest individual in the state to be serving this sentence. He is certainly not in prison now for a minor crime. He's one of two individuals that were participants in a double homicide involving a mother and a child in South Minneapolis in 2008. The distinction, though, is that one of the individuals, the older individual, is alleged to have participated, have committed the acts overtly, and the client that we represent had a different role. Nonetheless, the way that the sentencing laws work, because they were mandatory life without parole sentences, you couldn't take into account their differing roles, their ages, or their relationship in the sentencing context. There was a trial, a guilty verdict, and the sentence was administered within 1 hour of the guilty verdict. And I would tell you, in both cases, neither child understood what was happening. They would then go to St. Cloud. And ultimately, while they were still juveniles, they would be in the juvenile unit at St. Cloud until they reached 18 or 19, and then they would go to one of the secure facilities. Because almost every juvenile that enters prison at 16, 17, our client was 16 at the time this all started, picks up a lot of initial minor offenses that lead to solitary confinement, and they can be talking back to corrections officers. They can be not being private enough about different aspects of their prison life, not observing prison rules. They tend to de-escalate and spiral pretty quickly. So our client went first to Stillwater, straight from St. Cloud into Oak Park Heights. And we began to represent him after Miller was decided in 2012. In what we thought would be a resentencing possibility. Pretty quickly, our state Supreme Court said that Miller should not apply retroactively, that it would only apply prospectively. So there was litigation in there. He struggled in Oak Park Heights for a little while, and then had the prospect of resentencing in 2016 when our Supreme Court decided that Miller would apply retroactively. He has not had a disciplinary infraction since then. He's now at Rush City. He has gotten his high school degree. We are trying quite hard to get him into college courses. That's very difficult. But he's earned every certificate that he could possibly earn. So that story is not unique. There are individuals around the country who have been in for 50 and 60 years. The longest individual in the state of Minnesota is actually also someone we represent, who is currently in Oak Park Heights. He's been in for 23 years. I'm hoping he will be ready when his eligibility for parole comes up. I will tell you that he can no longer be in natural light without dark glasses and will never be able to be again. So there are institutional impediments that are just the very nature of it. And I say that quite frankly. I also understand that there are other perspectives here from other people who no longer have lives and loved ones because of this. So this is these are all facts. They're not to suggest that there isn't an enormous amount of hurt on both sides.
Professor Dennis?
Thank you, Chair. So again, I'm just trying. So the 16, the child was at the time. So that's the youngest known for Minnesota. And in terms of somebody that was an offender in this situation.
Professor.
Sentenced to mandatory life without parole in the state of Minnesota. There are other individuals serving life sentences in Minnesota, which are either 30 to life, in some cases 60 to life, in some cases 90 to life. In the case of David Brown, this committee, who's his family in 1980, who's serving a 120 years old story. So, yes, as the youngest of the mandatory life without parole individuals is Brian Flowers.
With these people that are serving, these young kids that are going in, do you feel like they're getting the care that they need? Because I imagine the crime, when you commit a crime like homicide, I can't imagine what maybe happened in that child's life to lead them to that. So do you think that they're getting, I'm not familiar with St. Cloud, the juvenile, the facility there. Do you think that they're getting the care that they need that's going to help them develop? I'm sure the hope helps, but do you feel like that's really, that they're getting those skills?
Professor Mariani.
Chair Mariani, Representative Nielsen. I would say not currently. And this is not a problem that's unique to Minnesota. Our correction system in the state is a good one, but it is still, we as a country haven't been about rehabilitation for a long time, so we don't have the programming. One really difficult issue for lifers is that they go to the back of the line automatically. So if there are only a certain number of program spots, those who need to sort of build up their resume, so to speak, because they will get out sooner, get those preferred spots. Juvenile lifers often go to the back. Because the vast majority of these individuals have significant mental health challenges, learning deficits, various forms of exposure to violence, what really needs to be there is something individualized that could actually meet their needs. Our system currently does not have the capacity to do that in a meaningful way. Some of that's funding, but a piece of that, and I'm going to say this to say, this is a phenomenon that pervades this country. Prison in the rest of the Western world isn't entirely punitive. It is therapeutic in a lot of, because there is a broad recognition that when individuals return to society, the rest of the community needs them to be functional and needs them to be well. And that's not something that we currently put our money into. So the answer, I will say, is no, but it's not because there aren't caring people who are trying to do that.
Thank you. Chair?
Actually, my questions have all been answered, but Representative Mariani and Representative Christensen and I went back and had those focus groups, and it turned out about half the people that we met with were lifers. In fact, one guy had been there since 1976. Didn't sound like he was getting out anytime soon either. And the one thing that one of the bigger things that I came away with is we need to address the lifers in some way. And if we really want to drop prison violence, they've got to have some sort of goals or some sort of something to look forward to. And yeah, I think what you're saying, Professor Moriarty was talking about, they end up at the back of the line because, well, program's not going to do any good for them. They're not going anywhere. So we need to, that's not going to happen this session, but it is something I want to look at next year. It's just going to make the prisons a lot safer if they have something that can incentivize them.
Representative Dean, final words.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a note, we do have a fiscal note associated with this, and because of the sort of far view, we really don't aren't able to talk about any savings or anything of that at this time. So, and I believe we do have one person that would like to come up and testify. So we'll have them come forward before I give my closing remarks.
Professor Moriarty, thank you for hanging around. I hope you feel that it was worth it. It certainly enhanced my knowledge greatly. Thank you. Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Committee members, my name is Carly Stark, and I am with the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC supports eliminating life without parole as a sentencing option for children. That is not to say we do not support accountability for children that commit crimes. We support just and age-appropriate accountability measures for children that will ensure every child, regardless of offense, is given a meaningful opportunity to obtain release based on demonstrated maturing and rehabilitation. AMC believes this bill will provide that opportunity by allowing these children to be considered for release after serving 25 years in prison and demonstrating they have been rehabilitated. So we'd ask you to support this bill as it goes through this process.
Thank you, Ms. Stark. And thank you for sticking around as well. We really appreciate it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Russell.
And it's things, this is a good bill. And it's things like this that, you know, make our job all the more important. You know, we've got to keep working towards how do we keep them from this point? How do we catch the youth on the front side instead of having to deal with it, you know, deal with the incarceration part? So I'll agree with you today.
I wish I had more bills, Mr. Chair.
You're on a roll, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I think that Representative Grossel brings up an important thing that we've been trying to do this year, and one of that is trying to look at a full spectrum of issues related to criminal justice reform. You know, when we talk about the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative is funding to try to make it so that young kids that are clearly about to enter a path where there might be significant implications within the criminal justice system are able to sort of divert their lives in a different way that makes them avoid that. And, you know, this is one of those instances, and it really wasn't until Professor Moriarty's presentation on the adolescent brain and brain development that I began to understand what happened to me. I was 19 and 20 when I entered the criminal justice system and the age when I went to treatment. And I always like thought, well, I was just fortunate, all the stuff happened, I did all the stuff right. But I was at that point where the capacity for change for me was probably its greatest. And I think that that's one thing that we need to be considering with young people in the criminal justice system is their capacity for change. And I think that anything we can do to try to enhance that ability to reach those young individuals that through a series of adverse childhood experiences find themselves in difficult situations, I think can be a key factor in really transforming the criminal justice system in the state of Minnesota. And I know we lead in many different ways, and sometimes some of that leading isn't always the best way to lead, whether it's, you know, the number of individuals per capita that are on probation or, you know, but it's good that we don't lock up a lot of people. You know, we're close to leading in that. But I think there are other ways that we can lead relative to reform and reducing recidivism of those individuals, making sure that our correction facilities are safe because we have the right type of staffing proportional to those inmates, as well as the programming that's so vital for those individuals. Before I ran for office, I had the good fortune of going to a town hall meeting who then Representative Keith Ellison was holding in my district. And he had a few young men that had recently got out. And there was something that struck me very, very strongly when they said, because they were speaking to the young men and women in the community. They said that when you're locked up, every day is the same. What you did the day before is going to be what you're doing today, and that's going to be exactly what you're doing tomorrow. The ability to have choices and a sense of self-destiny is something that I think is something that Unfortunately, it's real easy for us to get within our locked-up facilities, and I would just hope that as we continue to move forward that we look at those ways of trying to help those individuals transform their lives while they're inside so that when they get outside, they actually become an asset to society. So, Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you all for the latitude and what I would say is the respectful dialogue that we've had around a lot of the issues that we've been addressing. And although we may not agree 100% on everything, I think we do agree that we have opportunities to make some change. And before I close, I just want to thank Representative Johnson for the amendment this morning. I wasn't 100% sure where it came from, so I'm like, sure, I'll take it. But thank you again. That was a really critical thing to make sure we get the funding in place when we need it, which is really now. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative. And I do want to thank all the members. I know we're pressed to be in other places. It's been a long day, and many of you are here and have listened attentively, and I suspect have learned as well as I have along the process. And so thank you for the level of gravity and seriousness that you bring to this. Let's make this bill happen this year, members. So with that, the chair is going to lay over House File 1717 as amended for a possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And members, watch your emails and notices. We know we've got a big day. Wednesday, we have quite a few bills that are lined up, so it's probably going to be a really long day. Watch for notices of a possible meeting on Monday during the day. Our staff will be contacting you directly, but keep an eye out for notices. We're obviously entering that magical period of time in the legislature. Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, the Monday meeting will be in the afternoon if we have it.
Our plan is to do it in the afternoon.
Thank you.
Judiciary has a meeting already at 10.
Yep.
And part of what we did this week was to avoid as much as we could. We vacated Tuesday and Wednesday in order for Judiciary to turn out Judiciary Day today. And, it doesn't always get perfect, but we're trying to make sure that that
doesn't happen. I have to go down the conference committee for a vote. So.
Do it. Yeah. All right. Very well. So, members, with that, the committee stands adjourned.